Hi, everybody. Welcome to Realty Speak, the podcast, where experts answer questions and share real-world examples that you, the listener, can incorporate as part of your real estate investment strategy to build up revenue, realize higher returns, and retain more profit when you sell. Without further ado, here is yours truly, Bill Widener, and this episode's guest, welcome Alan Gerchkovich of Inspirin Construction.
Great to be here, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Alan, for joining us today. Alan and I met this past summer, and he invited me to meet his staff and see the operation. I'd been around construction companies, and when I was there, it was obvious to me that he knew and his team knew all the moving parts of projects and how he had them all covered. I recall walking around the office and seeing a posted statement that read, Alan, tell our listeners what that statement reads.
The statement says, "Trust me, I've been doing this for 30 years. The next statement is a lie."
Right. And what does that really remind your crew of and of you of every single day?
You know, in construction, it's a very difficult business. And it's a business where you need to see whether somebody's telling you the truth and how to verify if they're telling you the truth very, very quickly, because a lot of time and money is dependent on it. So when someone starts giving me vague answers, such as "I've been doing this for 30 years, or "just trust me," or "the check's in the mail," I'm teaching my teams not to accept that. You know, in our world, that's really called bull, and we don't accept that. So we want to see verification. We want to know that there's direct and clear proof of something getting done.
Please share the story with our listeners of how you came around to founding Inspirin Construction.
The family was in the trade contractors business for a while in the electrical side. And then I eventually worked for a couple of different contractors and then went out on my own when an opportunity came available to build a pretty cool project out in Coney Island. It was actually the Coney Island Amusement Park in Luna Park. So we started that, and then we built the second one by succeeding and built the Scream Zone. And we still have that client to date. So it was a great opportunity, and we were certainly thrilled to have that opportunity and start Inspiron.
That's a great story, Alan. Thanks for sharing. So let's get into the meat of our chat today and start with the two major categories around construction services: building maintenance and capital improvements. While the building superintendent often will take care of much of the general maintenance items, that person is not necessarily going to perform the major repairs or capital improvements. What's been your experience with that?
Building maintenance is really something that's a very aesthetic type of assistance into a building, whether it's painting, changing some lights, changing some light bulbs, maybe moving some tiles around or replacing appliances. A building super should be in a position to either utilize himself or herself and maybe another staff member to do that. Once you move into capital improvement programs, you really are talking about projects that really require oversight from the Department of Buildings. In other words, these are programs that require some level of approval to be able to move forward. And at that point, you just really want to make sure that your staff is capable, has actual experience in managing construction work, because by definition, it becomes a construction type of project. Sometimes they have complexities, whether it's mechanical systems, electrical systems, structural systems. And while a building super that's good for maintaining and securing a property may have a certain skill set, a lot of times you might have to get some professional assistance when you get into larger programs.
So do you have a maintenance program that an owner of a building would be able to use to take care of some of those things that may not necessarily be capital improvements, but the super may not want to take on themselves?
Certainly. You know, we have the ability to come in, whether it's a matter of upgrading your apartments, upgrading your hallways, upgrading your building, dealing with your facade. It's really a question of what does the building require and what does the owner want to do and how do they want to be able to spend their monies.
So Realty Speak is really about helping owners of buildings that are at some point in the life cycle of an investment, acquisition, holding, improving, and disposition, helping them save money. So how is something like this going to help them save money as opposed to them trying to do it themselves with the super managing it?
You know, a lot of times we're called in to solve a problem that's occurred for a building and now they need assistance. My first question to owners is usually, what are you trying to achieve? Because you know, it's a mistake to assume that you know what the owner meant to do. Many times as the experts in construction, we have to advise clients that may know less about a specific construction program. They may know how to build real estate. They may know how to develop, but they might not understand the concept of certain elements of construction. So we will come in and ask a simple question. What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to spend to accomplish that? And what are your barriers? And at that point, once we know more of what the building's trying to do, we will be able to advise. You know, even the vocabulary, we may be using the same vocabulary words, but they mean two different things for two different people. A building super is very different than a construction building super for a construction company. So a building super for a developer may be a maintenance guy, in art speak. And a building construction super is really somebody that does massive construction work in a construction company.
Alan, you mentioned before that the Department of Building sometimes has to get involved. Talk to me a little bit about what are the kinds of things that the Department of Building needs to be involved in, and what happens if they're not?
Sure. So the Department of Buildings is the regulating body for any type of significant construction work that has to take place in a building. It might be your building, but you still have to adhere to the specific laws and rules and regulations that govern New York City construction. So the Department of Buildings has a very specific requirement, and architects, engineers understand what the rules are and what triggers a set of drawings or what triggers the need to permit a job. And there are various types of permits. Obviously, the experts can advise a building owner on that. But to assume that you can do work because it's your building doesn't take into account the fact that you have to adhere to regulations here.
So what happens if someone does work on a building that required Department of Building oversight, and then there's a problem later on and there wasn't Department of Building oversight? What kind of issues can that cause a building owner?
Well, from the simplest issues, they'll simply stop your work and give you a fine. That's the simplest architectural issues, so to speak. From a more complicated area, you might have areas where you may have structural problems, in which case your buildings could be condemned. And even worse than that, you might have a situation where you're doing work, as you saw a couple of years ago, with gas or other systems that lead to fatalities. So you really have to respect what's being requested for oversight.
Yeah, and then I would imagine if someone's at the point where they want to do a disposition on a building, it would be important for these things have to have been done using Department of Building oversight so that they don't run into problems when their potential purchaser is doing their own due diligence before they actually close on the building.
Absolutely. And look, there's a responsibility with owning real property in New York. You can't plead ignorance. Those days are certainly over. So every expert that would be involved with a building owner can easily advise them when they are passing the threshold of requiring oversight. Again, we're not talking about painting a hallway, but we are certainly talking about more significant upgrades.
What is Local Law 11?
So Local Law 11 is a law that was enacted for the repair and regular checking of your facade to ensure that the facade is not crumbling, to ensure that the facade is structurally sound, so that pedestrians underneath your building are safe. It actually took place as a result of a fatality of a facade falling on somebody and killing them.
So is there a height requirement for that, or is every building in New York City required to subscribe to the requirements of Local Law 11?
There is certainly a height requirement. There is also a duration of time between reports and the duration of time between when you need to take place on that. You know, while I assume I know what the height requirement is, I don't want to say that because then you'll all of a sudden assume that I know best. But you definitely want to have your architect, you definitely want to have your Local Law 11 advisor give you those requirements, because there are caveats sometimes that occur within height restrictions, depending on the building and depending on how far set back your building is. So I would recommend building owners get that clarity from actual experts.
So, Alan, a lot of times when I'm on the Department of Buildings website and I'm looking at projects that are being done on specific buildings, I see something called LAA as the application. What does that mean?
Bill, that's typically a limited alteration application. a lot of times that's a fast-track application that can take place depending on scope and cost and size of the job.
And is that something that you handle yourself, or do you work with an expediter on that?
Typically an expediter. So while we can certainly fast-track certain elements for a building owner, you really want to work with an expediter, and they can advise you in the day-to-day nuances of the Department of Buildings, which we will then adhere to.
Tell us a little bit about what an expediter is and what they do.
So an expediter is supposed to be an expert in the ins and outs of the Department of Buildings, all the requirements that are needed to obtain a permit for a project. If you need to bypass a permit because it's not required, they will be able to advise you and monitor the progress of construction and then eventually sign off the progress of construction.
So using an expediter can save an owner a lot of time and frustration, I would imagine, and money by taking care of some of these things that they're already an expert at, and by virtue of the name of what they are, expedite the process.
In theory, yes. You just have to make sure you're using the right expediters and that they actually are experts, even though they're claiming to be experts.
Right. Well, as you and I both know and have observed over the years, whenever you're dealing with real estate, it's always important that the people that you're involving to help you with it are the right people. Isn't that right, Alan?
Correct, Bill. And I think that's why you're seeing the signage in my office that says, trust me, it doesn't work. I need proof and verification.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Alan, many investors like the idea of buying a building with an opportunity to execute value add. In other words, improvements that will increase the rental value of its apartments or commercial lease value in the case of offices and other types of commercial space. Is there like a price per square foot benchmark for various types of construction that an investor owner can use when they're doing their preliminary analysis on a building that they're considering purchasing?
There is typically, Bill, a price per square foot rough estimate for different types of programs. So, for example, there's a rough range for brick, let's say, or for painting. But there isn't such a thing as where somebody says, look, I'm on 8th Avenue, I'm doing a building A versus a building B. Is there a cost per square foot difference? To determine that for an owner, you really have to understand their program and all the micro components that cause the pricing. Then when you aggregate it, you'll get an understanding of what the square foot cost is, what the square feet that you're working with, what the dollars are. And then when you run your calculus, then you'll know what your cost per square foot is.
So what would you recommend to an owner that was buying a building where they saw there was a lot of opportunity for improvement in terms of general improvements and also maybe some major capital improvements? How would they estimate that in advance, or is that really something they could do? Could they come to you and get these individual price per square foot items? Would you have to see the building? What would you recommend that an owner do?
I think I would recommend that an owner, first of all, if they have the resources in-house, utilize your resources in-house. If you don't try to invent a resource, right? So you need a budget is what you're really saying. And to determine that budget, you really need to speak to experts that would understand all the programs you're trying to run and determine the cost for that program. A lot of times I hear from people that, my cousin or my uncle said it should be $5. What does your uncle or cousin do? Well, they fly a plane. So what does that have to do with construction? So you always hear these kinds of things that, don't have any bearing, but they certainly skew the owner's understanding of what their costs are. My recommendation, hire an expert and you'll get expert advice and then you won't be upset at the end.
So now someone has a building as part of their portfolio and want to leverage that value add that we talked about before, Alan. For residential apartment buildings that are rent regulated, the New York State Division of Housing and Community Renewal, also referred to as the DHCR, provides for owners the opportunity to increase the rents of rent-controlled and rent-stabilized units at an accelerated rate when the owner performs individual apartment improvements, known as AIAs, or major capital improvements, known as MCIs. While this process can be complicated in many ways, in the context of today's chat, something to pay attention to is DHCR's requirements around detailed, documented support of the improvements and costs in order to get the maximum approval of how much the rent can go up. What are your thoughts on record keeping and how it may impact something like this?
Look, in general, record keeping is absolutely critical. If we also at the beginning of a program understand what the owner needs from us, at the end, we can work backwards and provide that to them. It's very easy for us, and we do this often, to break up, let's say, you know, $1 million or even $10 million program, it doesn't matter what it is, into multiple specific programs that account and record keep the costs. You can then take that all that documentation and easily provide it to whichever city agency or state agency you need. So long as we know in advance what you need, we can provide that for you during our construction process.
So I'd imagine there are a lot of different ways that an owner can engage a company like yours in their project, or as you've been calling it, a program, and I like that terminology. And I've heard terms like owner's rep, general contractor, construction manager. What do all these mean? What are the differences, and what are some of the reasons why an owner would use one over another? And are these services that your company provides, all of them?
Certainly. So it depends how deep the owner's bench is, meaning do they have people in-house that can manage and supervise construction programs for them? If the answer is yes, are they skilled and do they actually have actual experience managing such programs? Again, if the answer is yes, great, then you can do parts of the management in-house. If the answer is no, now is not a good time to learn how to ride a bicycle on your own dime. So our company offers construction management, general contracting, and advisory services to owners depending on what they want to accomplish. If you want us to supervise trade contractors that are qualified, you want to see an open bid process, that's really construction management. If you want to see a closed book, just get a lump sum number, then that's called general contracting. If you want an additional layer of supervision above and beyond a contractor or construction manager, then that's called owner representation or advisory services. So it's really a question of what the owner wants to do. It's a question of how much the owner wants to spend. And sometimes there is a scenario where there are too many cooks in the kitchen just because the owner feels that more bodies help. But that's not necessarily the case. Some sophisticated owners understand how to run the program. If you don't, simply ask.
And then I guess there's another layer where somebody can do something called design and build with one organization as opposed to engaging an architect from one company and a builder from another. Why would there be an advantage to doing it that way?
In theory, design build is intended for larger projects where time is of the essence. So a lot of times, whether it's government work, whether it's multi-state or, you know, large programs, they want to be able to start it without knowing exactly what the finished product is. In that case, design build makes a lot of sense. The only thing you have to understand is for multi-unit apartment buildings, if you don't know what the end program is, you really shouldn't be starting the program because it's going to be cost prohibitive, especially if you run it past the budgets that you had. So that's the concern that you would have with design build. There are benefits. There are also risks.
So how does someone determine whether they should go in one direction or another? A construction manager, general contractor, owner's rep, design and build, or two organizations, one to design, one to build. You know, it sounds like, well, how do I know what to do before I do it?
I think one of the more important questions that you want to ask ownership is, how much money do you want to spend? How much money, even if you wanted to spend it, does your building allow you to spend and still stay positive? And that will give you an understanding of which way to go. In other words, if you're spending a very minimal amount, then you don't need all of these layers of oversight that'll cost your bottom line. They'll be considered soft cost. If you have more complicated programs, then you do need additional more oversight. I would recommend asking, you know, a professional that can advise them.
So it sounds to me like the first step for someone who owns a building and is going to engage in a program, whether it be small, large, or medium, should really reach out to someone like yourself and have a conversation and then make decisions based on that discussion.
I think so, Bill. I think it will be very important for us before we can advise an owner to actually understand what do they think they want to do and where do they get that information from. Because many times owners are assuming that they know what they're saying because they heard it from somebody. But why don't we just get to the correct vocabulary and actually understand what their goals and their needs are? Once we know that, then we can better advise them.
What are some of the distinctions around different uses of construction services for different property types like retail, residential, multifamily, mixed use, office, industrial, storage units. Talk to me about that a little bit.
So obviously different use of real estate requires different costs or requires different management styles. So you'll have sometimes for retail purposes. Retail is very, very critical on schedule because obviously of the high rents. Of course, other programs are as well, but many times in retail situations, a tenant has to guarantee certain turnarounds. So as a result, you have to really expedite everything that you're doing with respect to your construction program. Other uses may require different management styles, such as a longer-term oversight as opposed to a shorter-term construction program.
It makes a lot of sense. So an owner who's trying to conserve the capital that's going to be invested in these different programs really has to understand the differences and the nuances of the use of the property, the eventual use of the property. Like I would imagine someone who's renovating their apartment in their condominium or their co-op has a much different time. I mean, obviously, they want to get in there into their renovated space as quickly as possible, but it's a lot different than someone that's paying $250 a square foot for retail space and they want to start operating their business.
Certainly. And also, obviously, it's a question of how many city agencies are involved in the release and completion of your project. So the more agencies that are involved, whether it's Con Edison, whether it's other agencies, you need to take that into account. Because, as you know, the complexities increase as you have interagency dependencies.
Alan, please share with us how you estimate the cost of a program in terms of labor versus materials versus other soft costs.
You know, typically you have concepts of hard cost, which is hard brick and mortar put in place by labor, and soft cost, which is all the other costs that an owner incurs. So a lot of times when you're asking an owner what is their total cost or what is their total budget, they'll give you a number, but then you'll ask them, well, is that for construction or is that for your overall program? And sometimes the owner's eyes open up and they say, well, what do you mean? What do you mean means that they're answering the question that they only have the $5 or $10 million to spend overall for all their consultants and everything to do with their construction program, which means by definition, they have less than the $5 or $10 million to spend for actual hard labor and material construction. So you need to be able to set up those boundaries and separate those costs with an owner. Typically, soft costs range somewhere between 20 or 30% of a project. And then the hard construction costs are the other 70% or so.
So if someone's budgeted $1 million for a project, they could add easily another $200,000 on that for soft costs.
Correct. And those soft costs being everything except what the contractor is doing, brick and mortar, so to speak. You know, you'll have expediters, you'll have architects, you'll have engineers, you'll have brokers, you'll have anything else that's not a contractor.
Right. And if they really only have $1 million, then the hard costs, the project labor and materials can really only be $800,000.
Correct. Somewhere in that range.
So it's important for somebody to really think that through in advance and understand what the different parts of the budget are going to be comprised of.
And many times what we will do is we will ask a client and ask them, what is your overall program cost? Can you show us those budget line items? And they'll say, well, why? Well, because we want to make sure that you're capturing all the other consultants that you will have. For example, if you have a legal matter, are you capturing your legal costs? Because obviously that's part of your construction cost and things to that effect.
So how accurate is the final estimate or how inaccurate can it be? I would imagine there are times when people get involved in a program to do improvements and they find that the contract they signed for the construction ends up coming later on with a lot of change orders and increases in costs, some things that they didn't anticipate, really weren't ready for, and may not even have the capital to cover. How should an owner protect themselves against that type of situation?
I think the best way to protect yourself is with information. Having the time to properly do due diligence and understand what you're actually asking a construction team to do via those architectural drawings is key. Because what happens a lot of times is ownership, for lack of a better word, will try to reduce their costs with designers, pay them less for less service, and all of a sudden that you sort of spend 2-3 days probing the area and really determining what all the costs will be behind those walls, that doesn't take place. When does it take place? The moment construction starts and demolition starts. And then you find out that some of those areas were wet walls, for example, or some of those areas had structural pockets that you can't move. And that fundamentally changes your program. So my recommendation is spend the upfront time to get your information accurate. Because once construction starts, the clock starts ticking. And every minute that it ticks, it costs the owner money. So my point is, spend your time up front before that construction clock starts.
So folks, it was right there that Alan had to take off. But I'm going to call him back and we're going to finish up with a real life case study with some very interesting information that I'm sure you're going to want to hear. So let's give Alan a call. Hi, Alan. Are you there?
I am, Bill.
Great. Welcome back, Alan.
Bill, thank you.
I understand that you're going to share with us the details of a previously completed program which involved the gut renovation of a 25-unit residential rental building. Was that in Manhattan, Alan?
It was, Bill. So we had a gut renovation of a building in lower Manhattan, basically gutting the entire building all the way down to the joists.
Wow. How many square feet was that project?
It was about 25,000 square feet.
So it involved some major structural work?
Yes. So we had to hold up the building. We had some shoring. We also had some support in the basement. And then we had to deal with all the structural bracing for the floors.
You would consider that site work?
In the basement, you would consider it site work. Anything that you're dealing with structural bracing for the building, just to make sure that everything is safe as you're doing your demolition. And then we were rebuilding back the core of the building and then leveling out the floor joists to make everything level in an older structure, making sure that everything is structurally sound. And after that, we were putting in all the interior finishes.
Sounds very comprehensive.
It is.
How about environmental? Was there anything environmentally that had to be done? Were there any soil tests or anything that have to be done?
So they certainly checked the soil test, and before the permit for construction was issued, everything was checked and tested for abatement. Anything that had to be removed was removed during the demolition phase prior to construction taking place.
You know, and the reason I really like discussing this with you, Alan, is because it gives everybody an idea of what goes into a project. You know, people are walking around the city every day and they're seeing all these different projects going on, everything from renovations to out of the ground, ground up projects. And so it's really nice for you to be able to share with us the details of what happens. So I would imagine since it was a gut renovation, there was electric, there was plumbing, there was heating, ventilation, and air conditioning.
Certainly, Bill. So it was all of that. It was everything with mechanical, electrical, plumbing, sprinkler, with the facade on the exterior, window replacement, roof replacement. You really were gutting the entire building. We even leveled out the staircases, leveled out all the floors. So we brought the building to pretty much a brand new shape.
Now, is something like this involve multiple contractors, or do you pretty much bring all the subcontractors in, plus whoever it is that's on your own staff that can complete projects, people on your staff can complete?
So we, we'll manage the process with our supers, with our field personnel, with our project managers, and then we'll bring in qualified trade contractors to ensure they're doing the right job. They're following the drawings, following the guidelines, and keeping the job safe. At the same time, they're also calling for all the required inspections that have to take place during the construction process.
And at the beginning of it, you're making sure that everyone has the proper insurance credentials, the proper licenses, the proper qualifications in order to be on site and do this work.
That's correct. I mean, you obviously have to follow the latest city regulations and government regulations for insurances, for personnel safety, for OSHA protection and safety on the job site. You know, safety is paramount. You really cannot have any shortcuts. You have to pay attention to safety, keep the job site safe, keep them clean, and progress along. You get a lot further along if you keep your sites safe and clean.
So I'm not necessarily going to ask you what the total value of this project was, because that's really, between you and your client. But what was
about $10 million.
Oh, $10 million. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for thank you for telling us that.
I just won't tell you who the client is or the address.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not. What was the soft? So it was $10 million, including the soft costs?
It was the overall program for the client was about $12 million. $10 million was for us, and then they spent about $2 million on all their other soft costs and designers.
All right, so the soft costs ended up being around 20% of the hard costs.
Correct. Typically, it's usually about 20 to 30% of the hard costs, depending on the complexity of the program.
All right, and then there are two time frames here. There's the pre-construction, which is all the planning and getting ready to actually be on site and do the job, and then there's the construction segment of the program.
Correct.
How long were those time frames?
So you had pre-construction for about 2 months, making sure that the drawings were properly designed and that the trade contractors, which were procured, understood the scope of work. The schedules were established, the budgets were established, and we were working with the banking institution to make sure that all their guidelines were being followed. And at that point, once demolition was complete, we were able to move into construction.
So it's interesting, you brought up the bank. So obviously the client went out and got a construction loan.
That's correct, Bill. Construction loan was there.
Right. So if there's a construction loan, then the job has to be somewhat, I guess, pre-funded by you or the client or a combination of both. Because a bank is going to release funds based on what's been done, not what's going to be done. Is that right?
That's correct. So it'll release funds on what's going to be, you know, what is completed. However, you can also request funding for materials and for equipment, so long as you can prove that that material has been procured for your job specifically. So you can provide the bank with assurances, with invoicing, and at that point they can release certain pre-purchased equipment materials.
And you manage all that record keeping and submissions.
Our team does a good job of that. That's inspiring.
So you said it was about 2 months for pre-construction. How long was the construction segment of the job?
The construction segment was about 8 months.
So 10 months.
Well, 10 months for the construction and pre-construction. But after construction's done, you still have something called post-construction and closeout.
All right. So tell me about that.
So that's the process where everything that you were doing during construction was actually properly signed off, and you're ensuring that the permits get permanently signed off, that you get a CFO, which is a certificate of occupancy, and the job is complete, that you've transferred all the as-built documentation and all the materials and all the logs and anything that you need for maintenance to the building, and that way they can take care of their building after you're done.
So it was $10 million for the construction cost, and it was $2 million for the soft costs. So that's a total of $12 million. And it was around 25,000 square feet. So if we do the math, that's $480 a square foot.
That's correct.
So I think what we've established here is an interesting benchmark for that type of project. So a gut renovation of a pre-war building, right down to the joists, with a little bit of site work, including all the mechanicals, and it's about $480 a square foot. Now, you know, certainly we're not going to hold anybody to that for any future projects, but at least it's a benchmark that's been established here that our listeners can use when they're thinking about that kind of a building to add to their portfolio, and they're doing their preliminary analysis numbers. All right, so in closing, Alan, what are some questions that owners should ask themselves when anticipating a construction project?
Well, I think you'd really want to understand budgets, you want to understand costs, and you want to understand who you're going to partner with when you're selecting a contractor, because it really is a partnership that you are going into for at least a duration of time. So you really want to know references, you want to be able to search and understand who your partners are.
When a client is asking for references, I mean, obviously they could ask you for some references, and I'm sure you have some prepared references that people could speak to. For instance, this client that you just described, the case study. What are some other ways that people can do a little research to find out whether or not they should partner with a specific contractor?
Well, you can also go into the Department of Buildings, and at that point, you're going to be able to see any violations against contractors and any job sites that they're working on, just to do a little bit more research.
And then I would imagine if something does come up, they should really give the contractor an opportunity to discuss that so that they understand the context of it, because it may not always be necessarily be the fault of the contractor.
Correct. Look, it's a dynamic business, so you always want to have open communication. and just have clarity about what is transpiring and what has transpired. Just like nobody's perfect on the ownership side, no one's perfect on the contracting side. So I think if you have an open dialogue, open conversation about the good, the bad, and the ugly, then you'll have an understanding of who you are partnering with as you're going to go into the construction and the building of your project.
Well, Alan, that was incredible. Appreciate your candor and your thoughtful answers. While we've covered many topics around construction today, our listeners may have more questions for you. So they may reach out to you through your website at inspiringconstruction.com. Yeah, that's inspironconstruction.com. No spaces. And the next time we get together, we can chat about out-of-the-ground new construction, which I understand your company can execute as well. So that's Alan Gershkovitz, Inspiring Construction. Alan, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing all this thoughtful information.
Bill, thank you very much for having me on your program. It's a fantastic program, and I hope the listeners certainly gain something new, and feel free to reach out to Bill or myself for any more information.
Yeah, well, that certainly is our goal, Alan, and I think we've accomplished that today.
Wonderful, Bill.
Hi there, everyone. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining in for the next episode of Realty Speak, the podcast. You can subscribe right on the player and choose your favorite platform like iTunes or Google Play Music, or just search for us on your favorite podcast app like Podcast Republic, my fave on Android devices, or Apple Podcasts for iPhone. And please share our show with others. Just choose share on the player and choose your preferred social media platform. Of course, you can always get to me via the website at billweidner.com. That's BILLWEIDNER.com. And remember, it's not about us, but about how we help you make the bottom line rise. Until next time.